You're listening to a Rhino.com podcast. Yes, you are.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Rhinocast. Today's show includes an interview with Mystery Science Theater producer Jim Mallon, followed by the Lefsetz Letter with Bob Lefsetz. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Jordan Fields in the studios at Rhino Entertainment with the Rhino cast, and I am here with Jim Mallon, who is, what are you, the president, CEO? What's your title there?
I have been the president of Best Brains, Inc.
Best Brains, Inc.
Production company that created and made all 170-some episodes of Mystery Science Theater. I also was the voice of Gypsy and the puppeteer of Gypsy for 8 of the 10 years.
Prove that.
Oh, that's a surprise. Well, she's not here right now, but maybe she'll come later.
Oh, that's a cop-out.
It is. Actually, one of the funnest things I ever did, we did a PR tour one time, and we were interviewed by a station here in L.A., and they let Gypsy do the traffic report, and she said, "Oh, there's a crash over on Ventura, and if you want to go see that." And that was pretty fun. So there she is. She showed up.
I got it. All right.
And I'm glad she came out. I didn't know if she would come out, but she did.
Hi, Gypsy. Can I talk to Jim again? Hello? If you don't mind, take me through the formation of... Actually, before we even get to the beginning of the show,
yes,
tell me a little bit about yourself and you know, your own history, your path to Mystery Science.
The prehistory of Mystery Science and what I was doing prior to that stuff?
Why don't you start at your days at Madison?
Okay. Well, that's why I went to school starting in 1974. I explored a lot of different directions and ended up in communication arts, which I considered the sewer of all majors. It's sort of where you drop down to if you're not going to major in anything else. While I was there, I started doing street theater with this guy named Leon Varjan, who was like this brilliant, crazy man. And we would go out on the mall at the campus and do little performances every day for a couple of hours. And one day the brochures came out, or the notices, that the positions for student body president and vice president were opening. So we put together the Pail and Shovel Party and decided to run a campaign to get that job. And all we did was make fun of the competition and make light of the entire student government activity. But we ran such an effective campaign that we won in a landslide. And I became the student body president in Madison for the rest. I think I'm still the only two-term president that ever ran that student body. So, and we were probably best known for bringing the Statue of Liberty to campus. We built a larger-than-life replica from the nose up and put it on Lake Mendota in the middle of the, which the campus wraps around in the middle of a snowstorm in January. So the citizens awoke to the Statue of Liberty poking through the ice, and Northwest Airlines changed their flight pattern so that the passengers on their planes could see the Statue of Liberty as they were landing in Madison. So something I'm pretty fond of. After that,
so it sounds like you and Mockery go way back.
Yeah, I guess I have a history in that. I graduated from Madison in, I think it was about 79, and got together with a high school friend, and we formed a production company, and we made a horror movie called Bloodhook about a deranged musky fisherman in northern Wisconsin who was using tourists and to grind up for special bait that the muskies seemed to love. So we made that film on a shoestring, and it was a huge adventure, and ended up ultimately selling it to Troma out of New York, which is a schlock film distribution company, and is in your finer video stores today if you go look for it. And from there, I ended up eventually getting a job at KTMA-TV, which was a little, tiny little UHF station in Minneapolis. And my plan was, back then, we didn't have your iPods and your computers and your digital video cameras. And the only way you can make television is to either have a lot of money or get to a station. And that was my plan. And I hired Kevin Murphy, who became Tom Servo, as my chief of photography. I don't think he ever shot a video camera before in his life, but fortunately for the low-rent liquor stores and furniture stores that were the sponsors on KTMA, that didn't really matter.
So how did you meet Kevin?
Kevin actually was, I think it was a grip and then key grip on Bloodhook. But also, he and I had jobs at WHA-TV, which is the public broadcasting station in Madison. It was a pretty large place, and we worked in different departments, but I think that's probably where I first ran into him.
Mm-hmm. So he was working at KTMA with you?
As the chief photographer.
Chief
and
photographer.
And he ended up making the low-rent commercials, and then on the weekends and the evenings, he and I worked on different television comedy projects.
Okay. Cut to you...
Burning out.
Are burned out. This is what...
This is the true story. I was at a wedding in Seattle, and I was kind of burned out because we were doing our full-time jobs, and we were doing this comedy stuff, and it just wasn't really getting anywhere. And I talked to people up there because there was a lot of local TV production being done, and working with, at that time, was the sort of the rise of stand-up comedy, where I came out of Vegas and came out of Los Angeles, and clubs sprouted up all across America. And the people in Seattle from King TV, who happened to be at this wedding, were telling me, go find the local comedians, because they're all dying to get on television, because stand-up comedy is many things, but it pays horribly. Yeah. And so they are all trying to leap over to television where they perceive money to be. So the only person I knew in the local comedy scene was this guy, Joel Hodgson. And the reason was, where I edited the movie Bloodhook was right next door to his space. And so one day I'm out by the elevators, and this guy walks over, and he's got a boutonniere on, and all of a sudden a six-foot flame comes flying out of this boutonniere. And that was my introduction to Joel Hodgson. So I got to know him, and so when I got to KTMA and I was burned out, and someone suggested go to the local comedy community, that's when I gave Joel a call, and we met at a place, as Kevin said later, that was fondly known for its sulfuric potato salad.
You were in my mother's kitchen?
A lot of mother's kitchens.
Oh, yeah.
And I just threw out the idea, look, we've got this studio, we've got a little bit of money, if you got any ideas for a TV show, I'm here to listen. And then about a week later, he came in and he had two legal sheets of paper, and he had drawn a, kind of a stick figure of himself and two stick figure robots next to him. And he said, we should do this hosted movie, but we should leave the host in the movie. And that was the start of Mystery Science. So I figured, I don't know, it sounded kind of nuts to me, but it sounded interesting. And KTMA, because it was such a tiny little out-of-the-way station, had and no budget, had a terrible film library. So it seemed like a nice match. And
when you say terrible library, you mean it didn't have many films, or it had a lot of films that were bad?
Both. It didn't have many films,
and they were bad.
It had were really bad. Probably, you know, the cheapest packages that that station could buy. Ironically, it turned out for us that was gold.
Yeah.
It was, you know, some of the worst movies ever made, and we grabbed them. So we had a budget. The show budget was, I think, $75, might have been $50. Joel got $25, and Trace and Josh, who was the original Tom Servo, each got like $10. And we had a block of about 3.5 hours to do the show complete, because then the wrestlers came in at the next block, and so we had to get it done before the wrestlers were done. It was interesting because the studio was tiny and was right next to a metal fabricating place. So if you listen to the original episodes, you can hear the sound of metal saws tearing through sheets of steel as they form their products. And so there wasn't any time to write the show. There wasn't any time to do multiple takes. Those were straightforward, improvised episodes, and they kind of showed that. But it was enough, and after we had done 22 of those, and once again we were facing burnout, there was enough material that we could cut together the best 7 minutes of it, and we did that and got it to Joel's manager, a guy named David Campbell, who got it to Rick Leed, an agent. And it was just coincidental, or the planets were lined up just right. HBO was just looking for material programs to start its first 24-hour all-comedy network. And we happened to be there on the doorstep.
Now, was that your intent? I mean, in the course of that first season, the KTMA season, was that always your kind of? Were you always having an eye? Did you always have an eye on taking it to the next level, or what was your thinking in, when you started out? This is going to, we're going to go network with this, or this is just fun for now? Or at what point did you say, "Hey, this could be something else"?
That's a really excellent question. I think in the back of everybody's mind, there was always this thought that maybe this could go somewhere. We didn't really know how the show was working for people for a long time. We would make the show, and then they picked the slot opposite 60 Minutes. I think it was like 6 p.m. on Sundays, where people watching that station were pretty low. I think there were a person or maybe two that were watching. And then the show would air, and then Monday would come, and there'd be nothing in the media, and there'd be no phone calls, and there'd be, you know, well, we did it. It was out there, and then we'd do another one. But then I got the bright idea to put up an answering machine, and we put the number up in the show. And that's when we first got a sense that this show was really striking a chord, in because that tape would get filled within an hour after the show was broadcast. And it was people that were enthusiastic, but on the level of enthusiasm that said to us, well, something's going on here. And that really gave us a boost. And because we just didn't know. It was fun to us, but we had no idea how much people were really liking it.
What you just heard, you should have heard more of. For the complete, unedited interview, visit the RhinoCast homepage at rhino.com.
I never knew that all my dreams would be caught in a sewer grate while the rest of me just floated out to sea. I just wish there was something in the world to take my mind off this horrible, meaningless existence.
Does this sound like you? Because if it does, and I were there with you, I'd hug you, kiss you, and then slap you in the face. Why? Two words. Superfluous Industries.
Superfluous Industries? Who are they?
Why, SI just happens to be a world leader in the manufacture and promotion of meaningless pastimes and trivial pursuits.
Really?
Sure. Where do you think we got baseball, religion, earrings, and soda from?
Superfluous Industries?
Yes.
Well, what about nougat and pornography?
SI all the way.
So SI makes and promotes all these things. Just to distract me from reality? I don't know what to say.
You don't have to say anything. But I have something that I want to say to you. You're welcome.
I wasn't going to thank you. Actually, I think this is all kind of bullshit.
Superfluous industries, building castles for the runners-up of society since 1834.
Hey, if that's not a hit record, I don't know. It's Bob Lefsetz here on the Rhino Podcast. I don't know if I can make this podcast make you feel like it is the very first time you've listened to me, but I remember in the spring of 1977, driving around in my BMW 2002 here in Los Angeles, going to law school, and I heard that record. Ahmet Hurtigan has got some quote. He goes, you know, a hit record is something where you're lying in bed listening to late night radio in your pajamas and you hear a song so good that you have to get up, put on your clothes, go down to the late night or all night record shop and buy that record. And I can remember a couple of records like that. I remember being on the freeway hearing Marvin Gaye, Sexual Healing. And I wasn't the biggest Marvin Gaye fan, but I had to buy that record immediately. And I had to buy that record immediately by a band called Foreigner. A couple of the guys had been in King Crimson. And maybe that made me feel a little bit better about the band. Ultimately, they got kicked out by the guy who was the mastermind of Foreigner, Mick Jones. But I bought that record. I had to hear that track again and again and again. In today's modern iTunes era, I would have just purchased that track. But you had to buy the whole album back then. And the whole album really was not that great. There was that song Cold as Ice I never really loved. And Long, Long Way from Home was much better, but I didn't play the album that much. So I was kind of disappointed. And then the next album came out. And I'm going to play you the song that broke first right now off of Double Vision. Now, compared to what's on today's Hit Parade, that really sounds like an amazing record, especially the way that it changes and it keeps going into different spheres of the song. But what's this Hot-Blooded? I mean, at the time this came out, you know, I was in my early 20s. I never said Hot-Blooded. It was like something you'd read in a bad novel, and I never really played the first record that much, except for Feels Like the First Time. So I did not buy this album. You know, it has that other track, the title track Double Vision, which is pretty good, but hey, who needed this? And then there was even a cheesier track off the third album, Head Games. Now, it's like the guys had a book of cliches. We had Hot-Blooded, we had Head Games, but I must admit, in the heyday of Napster, when I was downloading the catalog, I got a CD somewhere of the greatest hits of Foreigner, but one day I just heard that on the radio. I said, I gotta have that! That's actually a great track with a bad title. And there's one other big hit off that album called Dirty White Boy, which is just so stupid. I mean, these were well-constructed records, but who cared? You know, people in the Midwest. The Midwest isn't the way it used to be. Now everybody's sophisticated with cable TV and the internet, but they were playing this record like they were dumbing it down, and it really kind of bummed me out, and I wanted nothing to do with the band. And then I heard the band was going to work with the best record producer in the world. The best record producer in this world is this guy, Robert John Mutt Lange, or as they say, he's originally from South Africa, but as they say in the UK, Langa. I always think of Lang Ski Boots. Robert Lang is not with us, and we just called it Lang here. I skied in Lang Ski Boots for decades until all of a sudden my feet were going to fall off. I felt like they were in traps, and I'd have to bite them off in order to survive. And I got very excited. Mutt Lange hit the scene primarily with his band City Boy on Mercury, but then he had a breakthrough with the AC/DC records and went on to make some of the great records, biggest selling records in addition of all time, whether it be Def Leppard, Hysteria, and Pyromania, whether it be Brian Adams waking up the neighbors. And now he's married to and makes those incredible Shania Twain records, incredible in sales. I'm not the biggest fan of hers, but they're very slick records. The amazing thing about Mutt is Mutt can do the whole record himself. He doesn't even need the band. He can play all the instruments, write the songs, and actually sing the songs. The demos are unbelievable. He'll call you on the phone, and he'll actually sing the song to you. So I got excited because the best hard rock record ever made is Back in Black, which I'd love to do a whole podcast on, but unfortunately, it's no longer owned by Warner. It's being distributed by on Epic Records, part of the Sony BMG group. So one was very excited, and one eventually heard this initial track from Foreigner 4, produced by Mutt Lange.
Oh! ultimately, Junior Walker starts to blow in the middle of this song, which we white people knew from Shotgun, one of the great Motown tracks of the 60s, is the record's like a tour de force. It had that dumb title, Urgent, but did you hear all the instrumentation, just the sounds in the background? Those are trademarks of a Mutt Lange record. You know, I was burned out on Foreigner. Don't forget, it was before the days of internet radio, before the days of satellite radio. You heard these songs again and again and again and again. I mean, every Friday night and Saturday night, you'd hear Ozzy Flying High Again. You'd hear the J. Geils Band. And I heard this, and he'd say, you know, that's pretty good. But I am not going to buy the album because I know Foreigner, they put out crappy albums. I was running the U.S. office of this company, Sanctuary Music, still driving the same 2002 and 1984, 10 years later. And the stereo had been ripped out of that car five times. So I would drive a little AM/FM on the passenger seat. Ultimately, the antenna broke up and I had a broke off and I had a little wire. And I remember that, you know, music business, you have these kind of jobs where basically you're working 24/7. I remember driving home from the office one day and hearing this song from Foreigner 4. Know what it's like to make a masterpiece. I mean, I'm a writer, and it just comes right off my – sorry, I'm a little under the weather today. I'm coming back, though. Don't worry about it. And, you know, I let my fingers fly, and one of the worst things that can happen is about two-thirds of the way through, I'm writing something and go, fuck, this is really good. And then I can never complete it. It's quite that quality level. It's only if I'm in the trance and I can't break the trance. And the way they make these records is they build them painstakingly. And they had the framework of the song. They must have known they had a great track. And weren't they worried they were going to fuck it up? But instead, they came out with something absolutely perfect. All the little Phillips, you know, that part just kills me. And Lou Gramm sounds so sincere. He's been waiting for this one specific girl. Actually, at the end of the summer, I met someone who I ended up I'm no longer with that person anymore. This is, I mean, I don't know how come all the kids discovering the Doors and Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix can't discover waiting for a Girl Like You. I don't know why there's absolutely no buzz on Foreigner. So I had to buy the record as soon as I heard that track. And there's another killer track that I'll play right now from Foreigner 4.
Standing in the rain. Head hung low, couldn't get a ticket, it was a sold out show. Heard the roar of the crowd, he could picture the scene. Put his ear to the wall, and like a distant scream, he heard one guitar just blow him away. So stop.
know, in a long tradition of songwriters writing about what it's like to be them, and it's like writers writing about what it's like to write, usually people are not interested, but there's a small subculture of these, or a cult of these songs that are really good. I think, of course, of Bad Company song from Straight Shooter, Shooting Star, you know, Mama was a schoolboy, whatever it was, when he heard his first Beatles song, Love Me Do, I think it was, and from there, didn't take him. I'm a huge Bad Company fan. That's another band from the 70s that cannot get arrested today. We have Paul Rogers singing with Queen. And all of a sudden, Foreigner, you know, like 8 years later, is bigger than they ever were. And the band becomes full of themselves, and they put out this album, Agent Provocateur. This is that, you know, a title like that is kind of like the, you know, the who's the guy on Capitol who, hold on a second. Billy Squier. Remember he made that pink video and killed his career? Well, ultimately, the career of Foreigner was killed by this huge hit, which I'm going to play right now. Was a band for white guys driving around in Camaros drinking beer. That schmaltzy number completely turned them off. I mean, the band got so full of themselves. Well, we had a hit with Waiting for a Girl Like You, but as I said, it was made by Mutt Lange. It had a certain rock edge. You know, it's kind of like what we had a few years later with the Hair Bands. You know, they kind of moved it just a little bit to the left to be palatable to girls, but here they put it right in the core of the girl region. The guys completely rejected the band. And they had this MTV video, because it was the heyday of MTV, with a million backup singers. And this had nothing to do with rock and roll, to the point where it literally broke up the band, okay? Where the lead singer went on, Lou Gramm, to make a couple of solo records. A couple of them were actually good tracks, Midnight Blue and Just Between You and Me, and ultimately killed it, and Foreigner has never been resurrected, even though we had the touching behind the music. We talked about Lou Gramm's illness. But still, some of these records are incredibly great, and hopefully the internet will keep them alive. Till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz on the Rhino Podcast.
For more of what you just heard, visit rhino.com. Mystery Science Theater and Foreigner titles available for purchase include Mystery Science Theater 3000, box sets volumes 1 through 8, Jukebox Heroes, the Foreigner Anthology, and Foreigner 4, expanded and remastered. New and recent releases at rhino.com include Elvis Costello, The Juliet Letters, expanded and remastered. Glenn Tipton, Baptism of Fire, expanded and remastered. And Grateful Dead reissues, you guessed it, expanded and remastered. And on DVD, Tori Amos, Fade to Red. The Sugar Cubes, the DVD. and Beast Machines Transformers, the complete series. Text Pretenders to 74466 on your mobile phone to get official Pretenders ringtones.
Did you think that podcast was subpar? Do you think you could do better than us, Rhino, a powerful multinational corporation? Then email us at podcasts@rhino.com or call us at 1-800-546-3670. We'd love to hear from you.
You've just listened to a Rhino.com podcast. Visit Rhino.com for music, movies, and all kinds of crazy shit.